Welcome to ATS Mix.
I think until you start asking questions, you know, you're just going to buy whatever's offered to you on the 6 o'clock news.
ATS Mix.
This isn't a talk show, it's a freak show.
From AboveTopSecret.com.
I'd also be skeptical of the people who are out there selling conspiracy theories.
The Internet's most popular conspiracy theory discussion board. ATS Mix. From AboveTopSecret.com.
In the name of Christ, just let us in!
Starts now.
We were able to coordinate schedules with everybody and be able to finally interview Graham Hancock. And what a great guy he turned out to be.
John, I have to tell you, I broke my own rule. You know me. I don't like listening to other people's interviews because I think it provides some kind of a slant for me. I don't want to hear how other people did it. But I broke down and listened to his interview with Art Bell. No offense, Art, but I got to tell you, I think the members are going to find out that this is one hell of an interview that we did, and not breaking our arm to pat ourselves on the back. But off air, Graham said how much fun he had with this interview and that he really enjoyed the diversity of the membership questions that were thrown his way. So kudos to not only my partner, John, but to all the members, because this is going to be a great, great, great show.
Yeah. And once again, let me just mirror what Dave said. Kudos, kudos, kudos to the membership here at AboveTopSecret.com. You guys did a great job in coming up with some fantastic questions for Graham, and he mirrored that sentiment also. And you folks are really going to enjoy this. It turned out to be about an hour long after we did the editing, so I think you folks are really going to enjoy this. This is definitely one that you're going to want to put in your ATS Mix treasure trove chest.
He answered things not like in some of the other interviews where he is doing more of a lecture. He really answered these in a condensed form for Johnny and I because he wanted to answer as many questions from the AboveTopSecret.com members as he could. And for those members that their name was not mentioned, when we were scrolling through the question period with him, a lot of the answers were already given to questions that some of you asked, and it would have been redundant to simply ask him again. So please forgive us for not being able to mention everybody's name, and we had 3 pages of questions, but he did address a lot of the things that you asked.
And also, we were on a bit of a time schedule, too. We were exactly only allowed X amount of time with Grant.
Right. And it was nighttime, in his area. So.
And right now, let's not wait anymore. Here it is, our interview with Graham Hancock.
The following is an ATS Mix exclusive interview.
Well, Dave, we have been trying to get this gentleman on our show for, since the inception of the ATS Mix. And exactly. I could not be happier right now. Let me tell you about the guests that Dave and I have on the ATS Mix today. Graham Hancock graduated from Durham University with first-class honors in sociology. He then went on to pursue a career in journalism, writing for many of Britain's leading newspapers. He is the author of several bestsellers, including The Sign and the Seal, Fingerprints of the Gods, and Heaven's Mirror. His books have sold more than 5 million copies worldwide and has been translated into 27 languages. Tens of millions of people have been able to be exposed watching his TV appearances, including the 3-hour series Quest for the Lost Civilization. He is known as an unconventional, out-of-the-box thinker who raises interesting questions about our history and challenges the entrenched views of Orthodox scholars worldwide. His latest book is entitled Supernatural, Meetings with the Ancient Teachers of Mankind. And we'd also like to encourage our listeners to pop up his website, which is located at www.grahamhancock.com. The ATS Mix is very honored to have with us right now Graham Hancock. Hello, Graham. How are you, sir?
Hi there. Good to talk to you guys.
We really appreciate you taking the time all the way from overseas over there.
Yes, over on the other side of that huge ocean, here I am.
Hey, we have a lot of friends over in the United Kingdom, so we're excited to have one of our fellow brothers over there spend some time with us today. John, go ahead.
Very good.
One of the questions I want to just start us off with, what on earth was it that motivated a man with honors in sociology to move into archaeology?
Well, it was a series of accidents, in fact. After I left university, I went into journalism. I specialized in Africa, and at the peak of my journalistic career, I was the East Africa correspondent for The Economist, very serious newspaper looking at war, politics, famine, the economies of Africa. I used to travel very widely around the East African region, and particularly to Ethiopia. And in Ethiopia, I came across an amazing tradition. They claim to possess the Lost Ark of the Covenant, as in Raiders of the Lost Ark. And I found myself in a war zone in front of a chapel with a monk who said he was guarding the Ark. And that's when my adventure into ancient history began. I believe me, quite soon after that, I left current affairs far behind.
And did you happen to find out if it was the Ark of the Covenant?
Well, I actually believe that the Ethiopians do have the Ark of the Covenant, and I think it's been in their country for 2,600 years. And part of the adventure of that research was it was a very difficult time to travel in Ethiopia. There was a civil war going on, had to get behind the lines into difficult and dangerous circumstances, get close to some of the mysteries of Ethiopia. For example, why does Ethiopia have a Jewish population that practices an Old Testament form of Judaism, and could this be connected to the Ark? And I gradually began to put the pieces together, found a realistic route that the Ark could have come into Ethiopia, and got as close as I could get without actually getting killed to seeing the object itself. Because, the sacred city of Axum in northern Ethiopia is heavily guarded, and its whole purpose is to look after this relic that they believe, and I believe, is the Ark of the Covenant.
Well, you're a certified diver, and I was a instructor for PADI, the Professional Association of Diving Instructors, and we both have a passion for diving. Yours was cave diving. I also got a certification in cave diving as an instructor. Can you tell me about some of your experiences when you used to do cave diving?
I should clarify. It wasn't only or even mainly cave diving. Although I have dived in a number of caves, and as you with experience in this area will know, that's very risky and dangerous work, or it can be, especially if there's silt and mud in the water, which you can stir up and get yourself lost inside a cave. You need to take very, very careful precautions in caves. But the majority of diving that I've done has been down to depths of 120 feet all around the world, and primarily with the purpose of finding out whether there could be any structures underwater, ruins that have been covered by rising sea level. A good part of my career as an author, I have looked into the possibility of could there have been a lost civilization, and my book Fingerprints of the Gods and a later book Underworld dealt with this problem very, very directly. And my case has been that if we are looking for a lost civilization, we need to look for it about 12,000 years ago at the end of the last ice age, when the face of the earth changed completely and sea levels rose by more than 400 feet, swallowing 10 million square miles of land. That's Europe and China added together. Equivalent land area went under the water at the end of the last ice age. And archaeologists really haven't looked under the water for the ruins of a lost civilization. So I've spent a lot of time, and some of it particularly fruitfully, in Japanese and Taiwanese waters, but also off the coast of India, and in the Mediterranean and in the Pacific, looking for and finding underwater ruins that don't fit the prevailing view of history.
Well, you were talking about finding some of these structures and whatnot underneath the ocean. There is, I guess, some stone monuments that I guess were as large as Stonehenge, some 120 feet below the surface of the ocean off the coast of Japan that I guess that you had
investigated. I've put in hundreds of dives on those monuments, and I've played some part in bringing them to the attention of the world, because it's really a great enigma what we find off the coast of Japan. And I have indeed dived on a stone circle off the Kerama group of islands, about 40 miles west of the main island of Okinawa, down to a depth indeed of 120 feet. There's a gigantic stone circle there, definitely man-made. There's absolutely no doubt about it whatsoever, cut out of solid rock and on an absolutely epic scale. And it's part of a series of underwater monuments in the area. Truly takes the breath away. But because there's such a strong view in archaeology that they, you see, this monument at 120-foot depth has been underwater. We know from the geology without a shadow of a doubt it's been underwater for more than 12,000 years. And the prevailing view of history is that there was no civilization capable of creating a monument on that scale 12,000 years ago. Therefore, the monument itself rewrites history. And this has led to a lot of controversy within archaeology. And unfortunately, although there are diving archaeologists, their primary interest is shipwrecks, not ruins. And this site has never really had the attention from archaeology that it deserves.
All right, now I'm going to go into an area that I know you are extremely passionate about. It is your hot button, if you will. And it has to do with something that I became really intrigued with when I first saw this movie called Altered States, which was back in 1980. And basically, it delved into an area of using hallucinatory drugs and sensory deprivation situation to go deeper into your life. And I know that you have a huge passion about this subject. And if you would just take a few minutes and tell our listeners what you have experienced in the shamanism area.
Yes. This is absolutely central to the theme of my latest book, which is supernatural. And I never imagined when I began to research that book that I was going to end up traveling to the Amazon and taking powerful hallucinogenic plants. I had no idea that I was going to be doing that. I thought I was going to be looking at the mystery of human origins. But it turned out that this mystery, and particularly the mystery of the origins of modern human behavior and the fantastic symbolism and art and spirituality of modern human beings, it turns out, and there's really no doubt about this, I don't want to give a long, boring explanation to your listeners, but there's no doubt that it was the experience of altered states of consciousness brought on by hallucinogenic plants by our ancestors that led them to create the first great art, the art of the painted caves of southern Europe, which goes back 35,000 years, and took them out of a very long period of incredibly boring behavior and turned them into spiritual creatures that clearly believed in life after death, who started to bury their dead with grave goods, with food and with water, clearly confident that some essence of the individual continues on after death. And this was really a huge moment in the human story, and it happened less than 40,000 years ago. And academic opinion is agreed that it was the work of shamans,
right,
who were altering their consciousness primarily by the use of hallucinogenic plants and entering what they experienced as spirit worlds and then returning from those spirit realms and painting what they saw on the walls of the caves. Now, as a former journalist, I've always believed that I should experience what I'm writing about.
Right.
And since it became clear that hallucinogens had played such a crucial role in the birth of art and religion amongst humanity, and since there are still shamanistic cultures around the world that use these plants, I decided that I had to immerse myself in that. So I went down to the Amazon, where they have a most extraordinary brew called ayahuasca, which means the vine of souls or the vine of the dead.
Right.
It's a mixture of two plants. It tastes absolutely horrendous. It is, you really have, nobody should imagine that taking these plants is done for kicks. You know, this is something that you absolutely have to brace yourself for it. You're going to vomit. You're going to have diarrhea. You're going to be very dizzy. But through it all, with these terrible difficulties that your body is going through, which really requires strength of will, through it all, you are plunged into an absolutely seamlessly convincing parallel world at the level of your consciousness, and you can absolutely understand how the notion of spirit worlds, even of heaven and hell, of supernatural beings, because these realms are inhabited, you can understand how it originated. And I've come to realize that there's a great mystery about human consciousness.
Right.
Any honest scientist will tell you this. Scientists do not understand what consciousness is. Or how it works. But it seems to me, and I draw this from now many years of experience with this strange Amazonian brew, that our consciousness normally in day-to-day life is tuned into a very narrow wavelength. This is the alert problem-solving state of consciousness that's useful for us to survive in the hubbub of the modern world. But there are many other kinds of consciousness, and rather as we can retune a TV set to pick up many different signals, it's possible to retune the receiver wavelength of the brain in order to experience a much wider reality, normally invisible to our senses, that surrounds us. And it is this experience of exploring parallel worlds which I have found particularly intriguing and exciting about these shamanic plants, particularly so since people from many different cultures can explore the same worlds in altered states of consciousness. And normally when many people agree on what they've seen, then we accept that that's reality. And I think we have to consider that there is a kind of parallel reality here that we can only explore in altered states of consciousness.
Yeah, I totally agree with you.
I'd like to add a small disclaimer, if I could, that the Above Network LLC and the ATS Mix both are not advocating the use of illicit or illegal drugs. And I believe also, Graham, you also are not advocating people to take drugs.
I'm not advocating the use of drugs at all. One thing I do advocate, however, is adult responsibility.
Right.
I do believe as a matter of political principle, if you like, that adults in an advanced, developed society should be free to explore the mystery of their own consciousness, and that a society which seeks to legislate what we do and do not do with our own consciousness is in danger of invading the sovereignty of the individual in most horrific and unhelpful ways.
Sure.
We must be sovereign over our own consciousness.
And I just have one
point to talk about.
Yeah, I totally agree, and I just have one thing to say about that before I toss it to Johnny, and that is there was a bunch of us in Vietnam that totally agreed with you.
Yeah, absolutely. It makes sense, you know. One of the terrible hypocrisies of the West is that we talk constantly about freedom. When I say the West, I'm referring to Britain, the United States, the whole of the industrialized world, really.
Right.
We talk so much about freedom, and we wish to impose our model of freedom on other cultures, and yet within our own cultures, rooted and grounded in our own cultures, is the most grievous transgression of individual freedom, which is that my society may actually send me to prison for exploring with plants that have been in use in human culture for thousands of years the mystery of my own consciousness. This just cannot be right. If I'm not sovereign over my own consciousness, then I'm not sovereign over anything, and there's no point in talking about any kind of freedom, and let's forget about democracy as well.
Right.
Right. We talked briefly about the monuments that were found underneath the water there, 120 feet below the surface off the coast of Japan. I'm just curious, for there to be such a rise, a level of the ocean to rise, what type of cataclysmic event do you think might have happened for these to actually disappear and get submerged? Do you think global warming was
It's more complicated than that, although certainly it was a global warming of a form. The fact is that scientists don't really know why it happened, but there's universal agreement that it did happen, that there was an ice age, that for more than 120,000 years, most of North America and most of Northern Europe was lying under ice sheets that were 2 miles thick. I mean, you had 2 mile thick ice over New York State, you know, and we had 2 mile thick ice over the city of London in England. And these vast ice caps were stable for more than 100,000 years. And then round about 12,000 years ago, there was a ferocious meltdown. And sea level rose dramatically all around the world. And that was the end of the Ice Age. And after that, the world looked completely different. Britain was joined to mainland Europe at that time. It isn't anymore. You could walk from Siberia into Alaska. Taiwan was joined to the mainland of China. The world was a completely different place. And my argument is that archaeology cannot claim to have got to grips with the whole story of our past if it isn't prepared to look on those areas of land now underwater that were above water more than 12,000 years ago. And that takes diving, and that's why I learned to scuba dive, and why I put myself through literally thousands of dives over 7 years all around the world, because nobody else is doing this work. And, you know, I'm one individual doing it on my own initiative. If there were properly funded institutes which were prepared to search for ruins underwater, they would find a whole lot more than I found.
All right, let's change horses just a second, and I want to talk briefly about the December 21st, 2012 scenario that we all have facing us coming up as a result of the Mayans. What do you think is going to happen, Graham, when that day comes? Is it going to be like the Y2K scenario where we're all going to be panicking and whatever and nothing happens? Or do you think something's really legitimate about this?
I think there's something legitimate about it, exactly what it's going to come to, nobody can really say. The Maya are not alone amongst ancient cultures in the world in viewing history in a certain way. That there was a period in the past when there was a golden age, that this golden age was brought to an end by a cataclysm, that mankind fell, rose up again, and was destroyed again by a cataclysm, fell back again to a primitive state, forgetting everything, became a species with amnesia, and then rose up again. And this view of history is found in ancient civilizations and cultures all around the world. It's a cyclical view of history rather than a direct straight line. And it's a view that what goes around comes around, that there is have been a sequence of cataclysms that strike the earth and reduce civilization to rubble, so that we just have to start again. Plato, who passed down to us the myth of Atlantis, put it very nicely, that we have to begin again like children, with no memory of what went before. And this is really what's of concern about the Mayan calendar, because the Mayan calendar marks a clear end date for civilization as we know it. And in doing so, it draws upon a vast fund of knowledge that lay behind the mysterious Mayan civilization of Central America. And that end date is the 21st of December, the winter solstice, right. 2012. And there are specific astronomical observations. I have to pay tribute to the work of John Major Jenkins in this respect. Specific astronomical configurations that are going to take place on that date. The sun on the winter solstice will be rising against the background of the center of our galaxy, of the center of the Milky Way. And somehow, thousands of years ago, the Maya were able to calculate this forward in time and say to us, that is a signal that the world is coming to an end, and that signal is fast approaching, and we are in the period now when the Maya predicted the end of the world. Now, as I've mentioned, this was a remarkable civilization. They had superior astronomy. Their calendar, based on thousands of years of observation, was actually more accurate than the calendar that we use in Western culture today. And so when a culture like that says that some great cataclysm is going to strike the Earth on a particular date, I think the least we should do is listen to them. we don't absolutely have to go around wearing sandwich boards ourselves saying that the end of the world is nigh, but we should listen and we should take it into account in what we're doing. Now, there's a more positive side to the Maya cataclysm, because what they're suggesting is that a former world, yes, comes to an end, but that a new world is born.
Right.
That out of the ruins of the old arises a new, perhaps a new form of human consciousness is waiting in the wings to be born, which will no longer have patience with this world that we have built, and with the indeed the catastrophes and cataclysms that our civilization is already unleashing upon the world. It's also interesting, when you look at ancient traditions about this, that every one of them, whether it's the story of Atlantis, whether it's the flood of Noah in the Bible, every one of these traditions, and there's thousands of them from all around the world, implicates humanity itself in the disaster that strikes us. And
right.
I must say, in mythological terms, when I look at our society today, I look at a society that would be described in mythological terms as a soon-to-be lost civilization. Because in every possible way, we have angered the gods, we have lost the mandate of heaven, we have abused the privilege of stewardship of this planet. And that is the arrogance of Atlantis, and that is the arrogance that could indeed bring our civilization to its knees, and perhaps surprisingly quickly. So yes, I do take what the Maya had to say extremely seriously.
I have a quick follow-up question. Where do you think the Mayans got this information from about this warning about 2012?
I think, personally, this is my view. I've backed it up in books like Fingerprints of the Gods, is that it all goes back to a former civilization. that there was in the world, living around the coastal margins, more than 12,000 years ago, a highly advanced culture, a culture that was capable of mapping the whole world, because one of the legacies they've left us are a series of ancient maps that actually show the world as it looked during the last ice age. And if you're going to explore and map the whole world, then you're a pretty advanced civilization. And that civilization, memorialized, for example, in the myth of the so-called myth of Atlantis, was destroyed by a gigantic cataclysm. There were survivors. They sought to establish themselves at various locations around the world, and they passed down a tradition and a memory and a warning of what happened before and what will return again. And I think the Maya were the inheritors of that ancient system of knowledge.
Well, then that actually kind of makes sense, because if I recall correctly, in La Venta, Mexico, they have those huge heads, which I believe are called the Olmecs or something
like that. The Olmec heads.
Yes.
Absolutely extraordinary.
And yes. I mean, they have the facial features of Africans and other yes. cultures. And it doesn't make sense to me how they could be there in Mexico.
Yeah, exactly. When we realize that they're thousands of years older than the time when Africa and the New World were supposed to have come into contact, in other words, at the time of Columbus. These Olmec heads go back thousands of years before that. They're gigantic stone sculptures, and they do most definitely represent African individuals. So they are also a testament to a lost period of history, some connection between the New World and Africa that goes back deep into prehistory, memorialized in those gigantic sculptures. And it's a it's just a huge series of unexplained mysteries like these. The mystery of the Great Pyramid of Giza, for goodness sake. I mean, you know, 6 million ton monuments, perfectly perfectly oriented to true north, south, east, and west.
Right.
I mean, within a tiny fraction of a single degree, almost space age accuracy. No
right.
modern architect could do it.
No,
and this building is supposed is one of the according to conventional history, it's one of the oldest buildings standing in Egypt. There's no background to it; it just comes out of nowhere, and they, you know, they're putting it at the date of 2,500 BC. But what I'm suggesting is that the knowledge that is expressed in the Great Pyramid must go back much, much earlier than that, and have been brought to the fore again at the time of that construction project. You know, you don't see hundreds of years of preparation to build the Great Pyramid. It's like somebody just switches on a light, and there it is. And so it's a series of mysteries like this that lead me to suspect that we have got a huge forgotten episode in human history. We are a species with amnesia. And until we get to grips with this aspect of our past, you know, we're not going to be able to move forward to the future. You know.
Yeah, I think some of us have more than just amnesia, Graham.
Dave yeah, can't remember indeed. What he had for breakfast yesterday.
Indeed, yes, I know.
Yeah, I'm 59. I wake up in the morning, look in the mirror, and go, who the hell is that, you know?
Who's that one? Yeah, I have that experience too, yeah.
This is Bob. He's a hard-working 30-something male that is well-liked at the office. But Bob is hiding a secret affliction that he's hidden all his life. You see, Bob suffers from what has just been recently diagnosed as politicus uneducatus. Fortunately for Bob and millions of sufferers like him, there is help available for the politically uninformed. And it's available free 24 hours a day to anyone connected to the internet. All Bob has to do is type in www.abovepolitics.com and his disease soon will disappear completely. With Above Politics, Bob can now be informed in what's happening not only with the U.S., but also in the worldwide politics arena. It doesn't matter if it's liberal, conservative, socialized, moderate, or other, Bob can't help but become better educated. He'll soon be up to speed on important issues on topics like the economy, military and security action, energy and science, religious and spiritual influences. And when it comes to finding out the latest on the political players' motivation and sentiments, Bob now will know the difference from the left and the right and everything in between. If you cringe at political discussions around the water cooler like Bob does, grab a pen and paper now and write this web address down. www.abovepolitics.com. It will change your life forever.
This concludes part one of this interview. Please continue with part two.